They tend to haunt at night, and they can see you coming. Will found it difficult to believe what he was hearing. Hort seemed so matter-of-fact about it all, and Gillen and Merrin were obviously disturbed by his news. There was an awkward silence, which Gillen broke by asking, "What makes Crowley think that Morgarath is using them?" Hort hesitated. He'd been told Crowley's thoughts in private council. Then he shrugged. They'd all need to know about it sooner or later. And they were all members of the Ranger Corps, even Will. "He's already used them twice in the past year, to kill Lord Northolt and Lord Loriac." The three younger men all exchanged puzzled glances, so he went on. "Northolt was thought to be killed by a bear, remember?" Will nodded slowly. He remembered now. On his first day as Hort's apprentice, the ranger had received news of the Supreme Commander's death. "I thought at the time that Northolt was too skilled a hunter to be killed that way. Crowley evidently agrees. But what about Loriac? Everyone said it was a stroke." It was Merrin who asked this question. Hort glanced at him briefly, then answered, "You'd heard that, had you? Well, his physician was most surprised, said he'd never seen a healthier man. On the other hand..." He paused, and Gillen finished the thought. "It could have been the work of the Kalkara." Hort nodded. "Exactly. We don't know the full effects of the freezing stare they've developed. Maintained over a long enough time, the terror could well be enough to stop a man's heart. And there were vague reports that a large, dark animal was seen in the area." Again, silence settled over the small group under the trees. Around them, rangers bustled to and fro, striking camp and saddling their horses. Hort finally roused them all from their thoughts. "We'd best be moving. Merrin, you'll need to return to your fief. Crowley wants the army alerted and mobilized. Orders will be distributed in a few minutes." Merrin nodded and turned away toward his campsite. He paused and turned back. Something in Holt's voice, the way he had said, "You'll need to return to your fief," had made him think. "What about you three?" he said. "Where are you going?" Even before Hort answered, Will knew what he was going to say. But that didn't make it any less terrifying or blood-chilling when the words were said. "We're going after the Kalkara." 25. The camp buzzed with activity as tents came down and rangers repacked their equipment and tied on their saddlebags. Already, the first few riders had departed, heading back to their own fiefs. Will was fastening the ties on their saddlepacks, having replaced the few items they had taken out. Hort sat a few metres away, frowning thoughtfully as he studied a map of the area surrounding the solitary plain. The plain itself was a vast, unmapped area, with no roads and few features indicated. A shadow fell across him, and he looked up. Gillen stood there, a worried look on his face. "Hort," he said, in a low, concerned voice. "Are you sure about this?" Hort met his gaze steadily.
"Very sure, Gillen. It simply has to be done."
"But he's only a boy," Gillen protested, looking quickly to where Will was tying a pack roll back in place behind Tug's saddle. Hort let go a long breath, his eyes dropping from Gillen's as he spoke.
"I know that, but he's a ranger. Apprentice or not, he's a member of the Corps, like all of us."
He saw that Gillen was about to protest further, out of concern for Will, and he felt a surge of affection for his old apprentice.
"Gillen, in an ideal world, I wouldn't put him at risk like this. But this isn't an ideal world. Everyone's going to have to play his part in this campaign, even boys like Will. Morgarath is preparing for something big. Crowley's agents have got wind that, on top of everything else, he's been in touch with the Scandians.
The Scandians? What for?
Holt shrugged. We don't know the details, but my bet is he's hoping to form an alliance with them. They'll fight anyone for money, and apparently they'll fight for anyone as well, he added, his distaste for mercenaries obvious in his voice. The point is, we're short-handed enough while Crowley tries to raise the army. Normally, I wouldn't go after the Calcarra with a force of less than 5 senior rangers, but he simply can't spare them for me. So I've had to settle for the 2 I trust most, you and Will.
Gillen grinned crookedly. Well, thanks for that anyway.
He was touched by Holt's confidence. He still looked up to his old mentor. Most of the Ranger Corps did. Besides, I thought that rusty old sword of yours might come in handy if we run into those horrors, Holt said. The Ranger Corps had chosen wisely when they allowed Gillen to continue his training with the weapon. Although very few people knew it, Gillen was one of the finest swordsmen in Araluin. As for Will, Holt continued, don't sell him short. He's very resourceful. He's quick and brave, and a damn good shot already. Best of all, he thinks quickly. My real thinking is that if we get on the trail of the Calcarra, we can send him for reinforcements. That'll help us and keep him out of harm's way. Gillen scratched his chin thoughtfully. Now that Holt had explained it, it seemed the only logical course for them to take. He met the older man's eyes and nodded his understanding of the situation. Then he turned to organize his own kit, only to find that Will had already repacked it and tied it to his saddle. He smiled at Holt. You're right, he said. He does think for himself. The 3 of them rode out a little while later, while the other rangers were still receiving their orders. Mobilizing the Araluan army would be no small task, and it would be the rangers' job to coordinate it, then be ready to guide the individual forces from the 50 fiefs to their assembly point at the plains of Uthal. With both Gillen and Holt assigned to searching for the Calcarra, other rangers had to be tasked with coordinating the forces from their fiefs as well. There was little said between the 3 companions, as Holt led the way to the southwest. Even Will's natural curiosity was subdued by the magnitude of the task ahead of them. As they rode in silence, his mind's eye kept conjuring images of savage, bear-like creatures with the features of apes. Creatures that might well prove to be invincible, even for someone of Holt's skill. Eventually, however, as monotony set in, the horrific images receded, and he began to wonder what plan, if any, Holt had in mind. Holt, he said, a little breathlessly, where do you hope to find the Calcarra? Holt looked at the serious young face beside him. They were travelling at the Ranger's forced march pace, 40 minutes in the saddle, riding at a steady canter, then 20 minutes on foot, leading the horses and allowing them to travel unburdened, while the men ran at a steady trot. Every 4 hours, they would pause for 1 hour's rest, when they ate a quick meal of dried meat, hard bread and fruit, then rolled into their cloaks to sleep. They had been leading the horses for some time now, and Hort judged that it was time to rest. He led Abelard off the road and into the shelter of a grove of trees. Will and Gillen followed, dropping the reins and allowing their horses to graze. The best way I can think of, Hort said, in answer to Will's question, is to start at their lair and see if they're in the vicinity. Do we know where that is? Gillen asked. Best intelligence we have is that it's somewhere on the solitary plain, beyond the stone flutes. We'll scout around that area and see what we can find. If they're in the area, We should find that the odd sheep or goat is going missing from villages nearby, although getting the villagers themselves to talk will be another matter. Plains people are a close-mouthed bunch at the best of times. "What's this plain you're talking about?" Will asked, through a mouthful of hard bread. "And what on earth is a stone flute?"
"The solitary plain is a vast, flat area, very few trees, mainly covered in rock outcrops and long grass," Holt told him. "The wind seems to always be blowing, no matter what time of year you go there. It's a dismal, depressing place. And the stone flutes are the most dismal part of it."
"But what are..." Will began, but Holt had only paused briefly.
"The stone flutes? Nobody really knows. They're a circle of standing stones built by the ancients, smack in the middle of the windiest part of the plain. Nobody has ever worked out their original purpose, but they're arranged in such a way that the wind is deflected around the circle, and through a series of holes in the stones themselves. They create a constant keening sound, although why anyone thought they sounded like flutes is beyond me. The sound is eerie and discordant, and you can hear it from kilometres away. After a few minutes, it sets your teeth on edge, and it goes on and on for hours."
Will was silent. The thought of a dismal, windswept plain and stones that emitted a non-stop keening wail seemed to take the last vestige of warmth from the late afternoon sun. He shivered involuntarily. Holt saw the movement and leaned forward to clap him on the shoulder encouragingly.
"Cheer up," he said. "Nothing's ever as bad as it sounds. Now let's get some rest."
They reached the outskirts of the solitary plain by noon the second day. Holt was right, Will thought. It was a vast, depressing place. The featureless ground stretched out before them for kilometre after kilometre, covered in tall grey grass, made rank and dry by the constant wind. The wind itself almost seemed to be a living presence. It rubbed on their nerves, blowing constantly and unvaryingly from the west, bending the tall grass before it, as it swept across the flat ground of the solitary plain.
"Now you can see why they call it the solitary plain,"
Hort said to the two of them, reining Abelard in so they could come abreast of him. "When you ride out into this damned wind, you feel as if you're the only person left alive on earth." It was true, Will thought. He felt small and insignificant against the emptiness of the plain. And with the feeling of insignificance came an accompanying feeling of impotence. The wasteland they were riding across seemed to hint at the presence of arcane forces, forces far greater than his own capabilities. Even Gillen, normally cheerful and ebullient, seemed affected by the heavy, depressing atmosphere of the place. Only Holt seemed unchanged, remaining grim and taciturn as ever. Gradually, as they rode, Will became aware of a disquieting sensation. Something was lurking, just outside the range of his conscious perception. Something that made him feel uneasy. He couldn't isolate it, couldn't even tell where it was coming from or what form it took. It was just there, ever present. He shifted in his saddle, standing in the stirrups to scan the featureless horizon, in the hopes that he might see the source of it all. Holt noticed the movement.
"You've noticed them," he said. "It's the stones."
And now that Holt said it, Will realized that it had been a sound, so faint and so continuous that he couldn't isolate it as such, that had been creating the sense of unease in his mind and the tight cramping of fear in the pit of his stomach. Or perhaps it was just that, as Holt said it, they came into proper earshot of the stone flutes, because now he could isolate it. It was an unmelodic series of musical notes, all being played at once, but creating a harsh, discordant sound that jangled the nerves and unsettled the mind. His left hand crept unobtrusively to the hilt of his sax-knife as he rode, and he drew comfort from the solid, dependable touch of the weapon. They rode on through the afternoon, never seeming to advance across the empty, featureless plain. With each pace their horses took, the horizons behind and before them seemed to neither recede nor draw closer. It was as if they were marking time in an empty world. The constant keening sound of the stone flutes was with them all day, growing gradually stronger as they travelled. It was the only sign that they were making progress. The hours passed and the sound continued, and Will found it no easier to bear. It wore at his nerves, keeping him constantly on edge. As the sun began to sink at the western rim, halt reined Abelard in. "We'll rest for the night," he announced. "It's almost impossible to maintain a constant course in the dark. Without any significant land features to set a course by, we could easily wind up going around in circles." Gratefully, the others dismounted. Fit as they were, the hours spent at forced march pace had left them bone-weary. Will began scouting around the few stunted bushes that grew on the plain, searching for firewood. Halt, realizing what was in his mind, shook his head. "No fire," he said. "We'd be visible for miles, and we have no idea who might be watching." Will paused, letting the small bundle he had gathered fall to the ground. "You mean the Kalkara?" he said. Halt shrugged. "Them or plains people. We can't be sure that some of them aren't in league with the Kalkara. After all, living cheek by jowl with creatures like that, you might well end up cooperating with them, just to ensure your own safety. And we don't want them getting word that there are strangers on the plain." Gillen was unsaddling Blaze, his bay horse. He dropped the saddle to the ground and rubbed the horse down with a handful of the ever-present dry grass. "You don't think we've been seen already?" he asked. Hort considered the question for a few seconds before answering. "We might have been. There are just too many unknowns here. Like, where the Kalkara actually have their lair. Whether or not the plains people are their allies. Whether or not any of them have seen us and reported our presence. But until I know we have been seen, we'll assume we haven't. So, no fire." Gillen nodded reluctantly. "You're right, of course," he said. "It's just, I'd happily kill someone for a cup of coffee." "Light a fire to brew it," Holt told him, "and you might end up having to do just that." 26. It was a cold, cheerless camp. Tired from the hard pace they'd been keeping up, the rangers ate a cold meal, bread, dried fruit, and cold meat once more, washed down with cold water from their canteens. Will was beginning to hate the sight of the virtually tasteless hard rations they carried. Then Halt took the first watch, as Will and Gillen rolled themselves into their cloaks and slept. It wasn't the first rough camp that Will had endured since his training period began. But this was the first time there wasn't the slight comfort of a crackling fire, or at least a bed of warm coals, to sleep by. He slept fitfully, uncomfortable dreams chasing through his subconscious, dreams of fearful creatures, strange and terrifying things that stayed just outside his consciousness, but close enough to the surface that he felt their presence and was unsettled by them. He was almost glad when Halt shook him gently awake for his watch. The wind was scudding clouds across the moon. The moaning song of the stones was stronger than ever. Will felt a weariness of spirit, and wondered if the stones had been designed to wear people down like this. The long grass around them hissed a counterpoint to the far-off keening. Halt pointed to a spot in the heavens, indicating an angle of elevation for Will to remember. When the moon reaches that angle, he told the apprentice, turn over the watch to Gillen. Will nodded, rousing himself and standing to stretch his stiff muscles. He picked up his bow and quiver and walked to the bush Hort had selected as a vantage point. Rangers on watch never stayed in the open by the campsite, but always moved away 10 or 20 meters and found a place of concealment. That way, strangers coming upon the campsite would be less likely to see them. It was one of the many skills Will had learned in his months of training. He took 2 arrows from the quiver and held them between the fingers of his bow hand. He would hold them thus for the 4 hours of his watch. If he needed them, there would be no excessive movement as he took an arrow from his quiver, movement that might alert an attacker. Then he flipped the cowl of his cloak over his head so he would merge with the irregular shape of the bush. His head and eyes scanned from side to side, as Halt had taught him, changing focus constantly, from close to the campsite and out to the dim horizon around them. That way, his vision would not become fixated on one distance and one area, and he'd stand a better chance of seeing movement. From time to time, he turned slowly through a complete circle, scanning the entire ground around them, moving slowly to keep his own movement as imperceptible as possible. The keening of the stones and the hissing of wind through the grass formed a constant background, but he began to hear other noises as well. The rustling of small animals in the grass and other less explicable sounds. With each one, his heart raced a little faster, wondering if this might be the Kalkara, creeping in on the sleeping figures of his friends. Once, he was convinced that he could hear the breath of a heavy animal. Fear rose up in him, clutching at his throat, until he realized that, with his senses tuned to the utmost degree, he could actually hear his companions breathing quietly in their sleep. He knew that, from any more than 5 meters away, he would be virtually invisible to the human eye, thanks to the cloak, the shadows, and the shape of the bush around him. But he wondered if the Kalkara depended on sight alone. Perhaps they had other senses that would tell them that there was an enemy concealed in the bush. Perhaps even now, they were moving closer, concealed by the long shifting grass, ready to strike. His nerves, already stretched beyond endurance by the stone flute's dismal song, urged him to spin around and identify the source of each new sound as he heard it. But he knew that to do so would be to reveal himself. He forced himself to move slowly, turning carefully, until he faced the direction from which he thought the sound had come, assessing each new risk before discarding it. In the long hours of tense watching, he saw nothing but the racing clouds, the fleeting moon, and the undulating sea of grass that surrounded them. By the time the moon reached the preordained elevation, he was physically and mentally drained. He woke Gillen to take over the watch, then rolled back into his cloak again. This time, there were no dreams. Exhausted, he slept soundly until the grey light of dawn. They saw the stone flutes by mid-morning, a grey and surprisingly small circle of granite monoliths that stood at the top of a rise in the plain. Their elected course took the riders a kilometre or so to one side of the stones, and Will was content to go no closer. The depressing song was now louder than ever, ebbing and flowing on the tide of the wind. "Next flute player I meet," said Gillen with grim humour. "I'm going to split his lip for him." They rode on, the kilometres passing beneath their horses' hooves, hour after hour, one the same as the next, with nothing new to see, and always with the faint howl of the stones at their back, keeping their nerves on edge. The plainsman rose suddenly from the grass some 50 meters away from them, small, dressed in grey rags and with long hair hanging unkempt to his shoulders. He glared at them through mad eyes for several seconds. Will's heart had barely recovered from the shock of his sudden appearance when he was off, bent double, and running through the grass, seeming to sink into it. Within seconds, he had disappeared, swallowed by the grass. Hort was about to urge Abelard in pursuit, but he stopped. The arrow he had selected instantly and laid on the bowstring remained undrawn. Gillen was also ready to shoot, his reactions every bit as sharp as Hort's. He too held his shot, looking curiously at his senior. Hort shrugged. "May mean nothing," he said. "Or maybe he's off to tell the Calcara. But we can hardly kill him on suspicion." Gillen let out a short bark of laughter, more to release the tension he felt as a result of the man's unexpected appearance. "I suppose there's no difference," he said, "whether we find the Calcara or they find us." Holt's eyes fixed on him for a moment, without any sign of answering humour. "Believe me, Gillen," he said, "there's a big difference." They had abandoned the forced march pace now and walked their horses slowly through the tall grass. Behind them, the sound of the stones began to fade a little, much to Will's relief. Now, he realised, the wind was carrying it away from them. Some time passed following the sudden appearance of the plain dweller, with no further sign of life. A question had been nagging at Will all through the afternoon. "Halt," he said experimentally, not sure if Halt would order him to silence. The ranger looked at him, eyebrows raised in a sign that he was prepared to answer questions. So Will continued. "Why do you think Morgarath has enlisted the Calcara? What does he stand to gain?" Hort realised that Gillen was waiting for his answer as well. He marshalled his thoughts before he replied. He was a little reluctant to verbalise his thoughts, as so much of the answer depended on guesswork and intuition. "Who knows why Morgarath ever does anything?" he answered slowly. "I can't give you a definite answer. All I can tell you is what I assume, and what Crowley thinks as well." He glanced quickly at his two companions. It was obvious from their expectant expressions that they were prepared to accept his assumptions as ironclad fact. Sometimes, he thought wryly, a reputation for being right all the time could be a heavy burden. "There's a war coming," he went on. "That much is already obvious. The war gods are on the move, and we've heard that Morgarath has been in contact with Ragnac." He saw the puzzled expression flit across Will's face. Gillen, he knew, understood who Ragnac was. "Ragnac is the Oberjarl, or Supreme Lord, if you like, of the Scandians, the Sea Wolves." He saw the quick flash of comprehension and went on. "This is obviously going to be a bigger war than we've fought before, and we're going to need all our resources and our best commanders to lead us. I think that's what Morgarath has in mind. He's seeking to weaken us by having the Calcara kill our leaders. Northolt, the Supreme Army Commander, and Lauriac, our best cavalry commander, have gone already. Certainly, there will be other men who will step into those positions, but there will inevitably be some confusion in the changeover period, some loss of cohesion. I think that's what's behind Morgarath's plan." Gillen said thoughtfully, "There's another aspect as well. Both those men were instrumental in his defeat last time. He's destroying our command structure and getting revenge at the same time." Holt nodded. "That's true, of course. And to a twisted mind like Morgarath's, revenge is a powerful motive." "So you think there'll be more killings?" Will asked, and Hort met his gaze steadily.
"I think there'll be more attempts. Morgarath has sent them out twice with targets, and they've succeeded. I don't see any reason why they won't go after others. Morgarath has reason to hate a lot of people in the kingdom. The king himself, perhaps. Or maybe Baron Arald. He caused Morgarath some grief in the last war."
"And so did you," Will thought, with a sudden flash of fear for his teacher. He was about to voice the thought that Holt might be a target, then realized that Holt was probably well aware of the fact himself.
Gillen was asking the older ranger another question.
"One thing I don't understand. Why do the Kalkara keep returning to their hideout? Why not just move from one victim to the next?"
"I suppose that's one of the few advantages we do have," Holt told them. "They're savage and merciless, and more intelligent than wargalls. But they're not human. They are totally single-minded. Show them a victim, and they'll hunt him down and kill him, or die themselves in the attempt. But they can only keep track of one victim at a time. Between killings, they'll return to their lair. Then Morgarath, or one of his underlings, will prime them for their next victim, and they'll head out again. Our best hope is to intercept them on the way, if they've been given a new target, or kill them in their lair, if they haven't."
Will looked for the thousandth time at the featureless grass plain that lay before them. Somewhere out there, the two fearsome creatures were waiting, perhaps with a new victim already in mind. Holt's voice interrupted his train of thought.
"Sun's going down," he said. "We may as well camp here."
They swung down stiffly from their saddles, easing the girths to make their horses more comfortable.
"That's one thing about this blasted place," Gillen said, looking around them. "One spot is as good as another to camp, or as bad."
Will woke from a dreamless sleep to the touch of Holt's hand on his shoulder. He tossed back the cloak, glancing at the scudding moon overhead, and frowned. He couldn't have been asleep for more than an hour. He started to say so, but Holt stopped him, placing a finger to his lips for silence. Will looked around and realized Gillen was already awake, standing above him, his head turned to the northeast, back the way they had come, listening. Will came to his feet, moving carefully to avoid making any undue noise. His hands had automatically gone to his weapons, but he relaxed as he realized there was no immediate threat. The other two were listening intently. Then Holt raised a hand and pointed to the north. "There it is again," he said softly. Then Will heard it, above the moaning of the stone flutes and the soughing of the wind through the grass, and the blood froze in his veins. It was a high-pitched, bestial howl that ululated and climbed in pitch. An inhuman sound carried to them on the wind from the throat of a monster. Seconds later, another howl answered the first, slightly deeper in pitch. It seemed to come from a position a little to the left of the first. Without needing to be told, Will knew what the sounds meant.
"It's the Kalkara," Holt said grimly. "They have a new target, and they're hunting."
27. The three companions spent a sleepless night as the hunting cries of the Kalkara dwindled to the north. When they first heard the sounds, Gillen had moved to saddle blaze, the bay horse snorting nervously at the fearsome howling of the two beasts. Holt, however, gestured for him to stop.
"I'm not going after those things in the dark," he said briefly. "We'll wait till first light, then look for their tracks."
The tracks were easy enough to find, as the Kalkara obviously made no attempt to conceal their passing. The long grass had been crushed by the two heavy bodies, leaving a clear trail pointing east-northeast. Halt found the trail left by the first of the two monsters. Then a few minutes later, Gillen found the second, about a quarter kilometre to the left and travelling parallel, close enough to provide support in case of an attack, but distant enough to avoid any trap set for its brother. Halt considered the situation for a few moments, then came to a decision.
"You stay with the second one," he told Gillen. "Will and I will follow this one. I want to make sure they both keep heading in the same direction. I don't want one of them doubling back to come behind us."
"You think they know we're here?" Will asked, working hard to keep his voice sounding steady and disinterested.
"They could. There's been time for that plainsman we saw to have warned them. Or maybe it's just coincidence, and they're heading out on their next mission."
He glanced at the trail of crushed grass, moving irrevocably in one constant direction. "They certainly seem to have a purpose." He turned to Gillen again.
"In any event, keep your eyes peeled and pay close attention to Blaze. The horses will sense these beasts before we will. We don't want to run into an ambush."
Gillen nodded and swung Blaze away to return to the second trail. At a hand signal from Halt, the three rangers began riding forward, following the direction the Kalkara had taken.
"I'll watch the trail," Halt told Will. "You keep an eye on Gillen, just in case."
Will turned his attention to the tall ranger, some 200 meters away and keeping pace with them. Blaze was only visible from the shoulders up, his lower half masked by the long grass. From time to time, undulations in the intervening ground took both rider and horse out of sight. And the first time this happened, Will reacted with a cry of alarm, as Gillen simply seemed to disappear into the ground. Halt turned quickly, an arrow already at half draw, but at that moment, Gillen and Blaze reappeared, seemingly unconscious of the moment of panic they'd caused.
"Sorry," Will muttered, annoyed that he'd allowed his nerves to get the better of him.
Halt regarded him shrewdly.
"That's all right," he said steadily. "I'd rather you let me know any time you even think there's a problem."
Halt knew only too well that, having called a false alarm once, Will might be reluctant to react next time, and that could be fatal for all of them.
"Tell me every time you lose sight of Gillen, and tell me again when he reappears," he said.
Will nodded, understanding his teacher's reasoning. And so they rode on, the keening cry of the flutes swelling in their ears again as they approached the stone circle. This time, they would pass much closer, Will realized, as the Kalkara seemed to be heading straight for the site. As they rode, their passage was marked by intermittent reports from Will.
"He's gone. Still gone. All right, I'll see him again."
The dips and rises in the ground were virtually invisible under the waving cover of tall grass. In fact, Will was never sure whether it was Gillen passing through a depression or he and Halt. Often, it was a combination of both. There was one bad time Gillen and Blaze sank from sight and didn't reappear within the customary few seconds.
"I can't see him," Will reported. Then, "Still gone. Still gone. No sign of him."
His voice began to rise in pitch as the tension grew within him.
"No sign of them. Still no sign."
Halt brought Abelard to a stop, his bow ready once again, his eyes searching the ground to their left as they waited for Gillen to reappear. He let go a piercing whistle, three ascending notes. There was a pause, then an answering whistle. This time the same three notes, in descending order, came clearly to them. Will heaved a sigh of relief, and just at that moment Gillen reappeared, large as life.
He faced them and made a large gesture with both arms raised in an obvious question. What's the problem? Hort made a negative gesture, and they moved on. As they approached the stone flutes, Hort became more and more watchful. The Kalkara that he and Will were trailing was heading straight toward the circle. He reined in Abelard and shaded his eyes, studying the dismal grey rocks intently, looking for movement or any sign that the Kalkara might be lying in wait to ambush them.
"It's the only decent cover for miles around," he said. "Let's not take the chance that the damn thing could be lurking in there waiting for us. We'll go a little carefully, I think."
He signalled for Gillen to join them and explained the situation. Then they split up to form a wide perimeter around the stones, riding in slowly from three different directions, checking their horses for any possible sign of reaction as they came closer. But the sight was empty. Although, close up, the jangling moan of the wind through the flute holes was close to unbearable. Hort chewed his lip reflectively, staring out across the sea of grass at the two undeviating trails left by the Kalkara.
"This is taking us too long," he said finally. "As long as we can see their trails for a couple of 100 meters ahead, we'll move faster. Slow down when you come to a rise, or any time when the trail isn't visible for more than 50 meters.
Gillen nodded his understanding and resumed his wide position. They urged their horses on now in a canter, the easy lope of the ranger horse that would eat the kilometers ahead of them. Will maintained his watch on Gillen, and whenever the visible trail diminished, either Hort or Gillen would whistle, and they would slow to a walk until the ground opened up again before them. As night fell, they camped once again. Hort still refused to follow the two killers in the dark, even though the moon meant their trail was easily visible.
"Too easy for them to double back in the dark," he said. "I want plenty of warning when they finally come at us."
"You think they will?" asked Will, noticing that Hort had said, "when, not if." The ranger smiled reassuringly at his young pupil.
"Always assume an enemy knows you're there and that he will attack you," he said. "That way you tend to avoid unpleasant surprises."
He smiled grimly to reassure the boy.
"It can still be unpleasant, but at least it's not a surprise."
In the morning, they resumed the trail once more, moving at the same brisk pace, slowing only when they had no clear sight of the lie of the land ahead of them. By early afternoon, they had reached the edge of the plain and rode once again into the wooded country to the north of the mountains of Rain and Night. Here they found the two Kalkara had joined company, no longer keeping the wide separation they had maintained on the open ground of the plain. But their chosen path remained the same, east of northeast. The three rangers followed this course for another hour, before Hort reined in Abelard and signalled the others to dismount for a conference. They grouped around a map of the kingdom that he unrolled out on the grass, using arrows as weights to stop the edges from re-rolling.
"Judging from their tracks, we've made up some time on them," he said. "But they're still a good half day ahead of us. Now, this is the direction they're following."
He took another arrow and laid it on the map, orientating it so that it pointed to the direction the Kalkara had been following for the past 2 days and nights.
"As you can see, if they keep going in this direction, there are only two places of any significance that they could be heading for."
He pointed to a place on the map. "Here, the Gorlan Ruins, or farther north, Castle Araluen itself." Gillen drew in breath sharply.
"Castle Araluen," he said. "You don't think they dare try for King Duncan?"
Hort looked at him and shook his head.
"I simply don't know," he replied. We don't know nearly enough about these beasts, and half of what we think we know is probably myth and legend. But you've got to admit, it would be a bold stroke, a master stroke, and Margareth has never been averse to that sort of thing. He let the others digest the thought for a few moments, then traced a line from their current position to the northwest. Now, I've been thinking. Look, here's Castle Redmond, perhaps a day's ride away, and then another day to here. From Redmond, he traced a line northeast to the Gaulan ruins, marked on the map. One person, riding hard and using two horses, could make it in less than a day to Redmond, and then lead the Baron and Sir Rodney here to the ruins. If the Calcara keep moving at the pace they are, we might just be able to intercept them there. It'll be close, but it's possible. And with two warriors like Harold and Rodney on hand, we'll stand a far better chance of stopping the damn things once and for all. One moment, halt, Gillen interrupted. You said one person riding two horses? Halt met Gillen's gaze with his own. He could see that the young ranger had already divined what he had in mind. That's right, Gillen, he said. And the lightest one among us will travel fastest. I want you to turn Blaze over to Will. If he alternates between Tog and your horse, he can do it in the time. He saw the reluctance on Gillen's face and understood it perfectly. No ranger would like the idea of handing his horse over to someone else, even another ranger. But at the same time, Gillen understood the logic behind the suggestion. Holt waited for the younger man to break the silence, while Will watched the two of them, eyes wide with alarm, at the thought of the responsibility that was about to be loaded onto him. Finally, reluctantly, Gillen broke the silence. I suppose it makes sense, he said. So what do you want me to do? Follow behind me on foot, Holt said briskly, rolling the chart up and replacing it in his saddlebag. If you can get hold of a horse anywhere, do so and catch up with me. Otherwise, we'll rendezvous at Gorlan. If we miss the Calcara there, Will can wait for you, with Blaze. I'll keep following the Calcara until you all catch up with me. Gillen nodded his acquiescence, and Holt felt a surge of fondness for him as he did. Once Gillen saw the sense of his proposal, he wasn't the kind to raise arguments or objections. He did say, rather ruefully, I thought you said my sword might come in handy. I did, replied Holt. But this gives me a chance to bring in two fully armoured knights with axes and lances, and you know that's the best way to fight the Calcara. True, said Gillen. Then, taking Blaze's bridle, he knotted the reins together and threw them over the bay's neck. You may as well start out on Tug, he said to Will. That'll give Blaze a chance to rest. He'll follow behind you without a lead rein, and so will Tug when you're riding Blaze. Tie the reins up like this on Tug's neck so they don't dangle down and snag anything. He began to turn back to Holt, then remembered something. Oh, yes. Before you mount him for the first time, remember to say, Brown eyes. Brown eyes, Will repeated, and Gillen couldn't help grinning. Not to me, to the horse. It was an old ranger joke, and they all smiled. Then Holt brought them back to the business at hand. Will, you're confident you can find your way to Redmond? Will nodded. He touched the pocket where he kept his own copy of the chart, and glanced at the sun for direction. Northwest, he said tightly, indicating the direction he had chosen. Holt nodded, satisfied. You'll strike the Salmon River before dusk. That will give you a good reference point. And the main highway is just a little way west of the river. Keep to a steady canter all the way. Don't try to race the horses. You'll just tire them out that way, and you'll be slower in the long run. Travel safely now."
Holt swung up into Abelard's saddle, and Will mounted Tug. Gillen pointed to Will and spoke in Blaze's ear.
"Follow, Blaze. Follow."
The bay horse, intelligent as all ranger horses were, tossed its head, as if in acknowledgement of the order. Before they parted, Will had one more question that had been bothering him.
"Holt," he said, "the Gorlan ruins, what exactly are they?"
"It's ironic, isn't it?"
Holt replied. "They're the ruins of Castle Gorlan, Morgarath's former fiefdom." 28. The ride to Castle Redmond soon settled into a blur of weariness. The two horses maintained the steady lope for which they'd been bred. The temptation, of course, was to urge Tug into a wild gallop, with Blaze following behind. But Will knew that such a course would be self-defeating. He was moving at the horse's best speed. As old Bob, the horse trainer, had told him, ranger horses could maintain a canter all day without tiring. It was a different matter for the rider. Added to the physical effort of moving constantly to the rhythm of whichever horse he was riding, and the two had distinctly different gaits, due to their difference in size, was the equally debilitating mental strain. What if Holt were wrong? What if the Calcarra had suddenly veered to the west, and were heading now on a course that would intercept his? What if he made some terrible mistake and failed to reach Redmond in time? That last fear, the fear of self-doubt, was the hardest one of all to deal with. In spite of the hard training he had undergone over the past months, he was still little more than a boy. What was more, he had always had Holt's judgment and experience to rely on in the past. Now he was alone, and he knew how much depended on his ability to carry out the task he had been set. The thoughts, the doubts, the fears crowded his tired mind, tumbling over each other, jostling for position. The Salmon River came and went beneath the steady rhythm of his horse's hooves. He paused to water the horses briefly at the bridge. Then, once on the King's Highway, he made excellent time, with only short halts at regular intervals to change his mount. The day's shadows lengthened, and the trees overhanging the road grew dark and menacing. Each noise from the darkening trees, each vaguely seen movement in the shadows, brought his heart to his mouth with a lurch. Here, an owl hooted and stooped to fasten its claws around an unwary mouse. There, a badger prowled, hunting its prey like a grey shadow in the undergrowth of the forest. With each movement and noise, Will's imagination worked overtime. He began to see great black figures, much as he imagined a Calcarra would look, in every patch of shadow, in every dark clump of bushes that stirred with the light breeze. Reason told him that there was almost no chance that the Calcarra would be seeking him out. Imagination and fear replied that they were abroad somewhere, and who was to say they weren't close by? Imagination and fear won. And so the long, fear-filled night passed, until the low light of dawn found a weary figure hunched in the saddle of a sturdy, barrel-chested horse that drove steadily onwards to the northwest. Dozing in the saddle, Will snapped awake with a start, feeling the first warmth of the sun's rays upon him. Gently, he reined Tug in, and the little horse stood, head down, sides heaving. Will realized he'd been riding far longer than he should have been, his fear having driven him to keep Tug running through the darkness, long after he should have rested him. He dismounted stiffly, aching in every joint, and paused to rub the horse's soft nose affectionately.
"Sorry, boy," he said.
Tug, reacting to the touch and the voice that he now knew so well,
tossed his head and shook his shaggy mane. If Will had asked it, he would have continued uncomplaining until he dropped. Will looked around. The cheerful light of early morning had dispelled all the dark fears of the night before. Now, he felt slightly foolish as he remembered those moments of choking panic. Stiffly, he dismounted, then loosened the girth straps on the saddle. He gave his horse 10 minutes respite, until Tug's breathing seemed to settle and his sides ceased heaving. Then, marvelling at the recuperative powers and endurance of the ranger horse breed, he tightened the girths on Blaze's saddle and swung astride the bay, groaning softly as he did so. Ranger horses might recover quickly. Ranger apprentices took a little longer. It was late morning when Castle Redmond finally came in sight. Will was riding Tug again, the small horse seemingly none the worse for the hard night he'd put in, as they crested the last row of hills and the green valley of Arold's Barony stretched out before them. Exhausted, Will stopped for a few seconds, leaning tiredly on the pommel. They'd come so far, so quickly. He looked with relief on the familiar sight of the castle, and the tidy little village that nestled contentedly in its shadow. Smoke was rising from chimneys. Farmers were walking slowly home from their fields for their midday meal. The castle itself stood solid and reassuring in its bulk at the crest of the hill. "It all looks so normal," Will said to his horse. Somehow, he realized, he'd been expecting to find things changed. The kingdom was about to go to war again for the first time in 15 years. But here, life went on as normal. Then, realizing he was wasting time, he urged Tug forward until he was stretched out in a gallop, both boy and horse eager to finish this final leg of their journey. People looked up in surprise at the rapid passing of the small, green and grey-clad figure, hunched low over the neck of his dusty horse, with a larger bay horse following behind. One or two of the villagers recognized Will and called a greeting, but their words were lost in the rattle of hooves. The rattle turned to an echoing drumming as they swept across the lowered drawbridge into the foreyard of the castle itself. Then the drumming became an urgent clattering on the cobblestones of the yard. Will drew back lightly on the reins, and Tug slid to a halt by the entrance to Baron Arold's tower. The two men-at-arms on duty there, surprised by his sudden appearance and breakneck pace, stepped forward and barred his way with their crossed pikes.
"Just a moment, you," said one of them, a corporal. "Where do you think you're off to in such a clatter and a rush?"
Will opened his mouth to reply, but before words could form, an angry voice boomed from behind him.
"What the hell do you think you're doing, you idiot? Don't you recognize a King's Ranger when you see one?"
It was Sir Rodney, striding across the courtyard on his way to see the Baron. The two sentries stiffened to attention as Will turned, gratefully, to the battlemaster. "Sir Rodney," he said, "I have an urgent message from Halt for Lord Arold and yourself." As Halt had observed to Will after the boar hunt, the battlemaster was a shrewd man. He took in Will's dishevelled clothing, the two dusty horses, standing, heads drooping tiredly, and realized this was no time for a lot of foolish questions. He jerked a thumb at the doorway.
"Best come in and tell us, then."
He then turned to the sentries.
"Have these horses looked after? Feed and water them."
"Not too much of either, please, Sir Rodney," Will said quickly. "Just a small amount of grain and water, and maybe you could have them rubbed down. I'll be needing them again soon." Rodney's eyebrows rose at that. Will and the horses looked as if they could use a long rest.
"Something must be urgent," he said, adding to the corporal. "See to the horses, then, and have food brought to Baron Arold's study, and a jug of cold milk."
The two knights whistled in astonishment as Will told them the news.
Word had already come that Morgarath was mustering his army, and the Baron had sent out messengers to assemble his own troops, both knights and men-at-arms. But the news of the Calcarra was something else entirely. No hint of that